Well, David, if you'd you'd be quite sure that the twisting and writhing talk had absolutely nothing to do with dancing, if you'd ever seen me dance. It doesn't happen. There's some small tradition, as I discovered, as I've learned over the years, for conversations, for Hale Prize talks, to try to relate to Hale, and that's an easy task in my case. I thought it was appropriate to at least start out with a talk related to George Ellery Hale, and then move on to things that are more uniquely associated with current space research than Hale ever had a chance to look at. And I'm going to use magnetic helicity as a common framework just to tie these various topics together. You've already had discussion, some papers that have used the topic of magnetic helicity and have introduced some of its concepts, so my talk is somewhat easier for that reason. Let me see if I can whip this into shape. There we go. The point has been made already in Spiro's talk about the conservation of magnetic helicity, and so that will loom large in this talk. And that concept unites not only the two things I'm going to talk about here today, but many others. Any time in physics that you have a conserved quantity, that's useful. That's a useful fact. And so we'll take advantage of that conservation property. On the one hand, we'll talk about the role of conservation of helicity in the framework of the helical turbulent convection that's present in the solar convection zone below the visible surface, and its contribution in energizing active regions and creating the twisted structures, and here's the Hale connection, the twisted structures that George Ellery Hale first saw. On the other hand, we'll add magnetic reconnection to the mix in contrast to what Spiro mentioned. There's a role for magnetic helicity both in and outside of the framework of magnetic reconnection. It has this interesting conservation property, and that conservation property survives in the presence of reconnection. But even if we don't talk about magnetic reconnection, the fact of the matter is that it's a very useful concept, and I'll start out with, in fact, with the discussion of Hale's stuff in a way that has nothing to do with magnetic reconnection at all. There's about a five-day SDO video here that shows active region 1158, which will, of course, loom large in many talks at this meeting. And I'd like to ask you to focus your attention on something that's just very, very obvious. Let's start this movie. Since it's going to run for 5 days. The obvious thing that these two panels show us in comparison to these two panels, the photospheric and the coronal panel, is there's a dramatic difference in the time scale between processes that occur here and processes that occur in the corona. You know, we've got gradual evolution of the location, size, and so forth of the spots, on the other hand, look up here in the corona, you see all that fluctuation in brightness. Really dramatic difference in these timescales. That's just your very first order, really bonehead reminder that this activity up there in the solar corona involves storage and release. And the processes go on entirely different timescales. So energy storage and electricity storage is a very important aspect. Let's go on to the next slide, which has got a great video in it that whose source I don't know. If anyone knows, please come up and tell me afterward. The whole picture, going back to Hale and to Babcock and so forth, of the emergence of magnetic flux in the form of omega loops is so graphically illustrated by this animation, which, okay, so it's got neon flux tubes, so-called omega loops, so what? It really gets the idea across, because part of what I'm going to talk about at this meeting is the role of the passage of those loops through the solar convection zone. And I think it goes a long way to explain some of the processes that Pete Martins was talking about when he was talking about the fact that if you look at filaments, prominences, sigmoids, and so forth, you see there are no rock-solid rules for things like hemispheric trends until you do a lot of averaging over time. The fact of the matter is that during that transition that I showed in that video, through the convection zone, those flux ropes are affected by turbulence. A picture like this one of Mount St. Helens erupting really reminds us in a very graphic way of how violent that turbulence is. And in fact, there's this paper by Kinsoglu, if I've got that name pronounced correctly, and Zhang, that nicely shows how this convection shreds these omega loops as they rise through the atmosphere. They used a time-honored technique, which I associate most immediately with Katie Lecca, who used the same technique for her thesis. And what is that technique? Well, it's nicely illustrated by their video of how they do it. They assume that omega loops are rigid structures and are simply rising through the convection zone, rising through the photosphere with constant velocity, obviously highly idealized, but still useful. They simply stack 800 magnetograms, one every 7.5 minutes, and indicate the polarity of the field as it goes through the surface by the red and blue color here. And so the technique that they use transfers from a magnetogram sequence to the structure they infer in the following way. What are the properties of the structure that we want to deal with? The structure that we care most about is this. Here are the roots of your omega loops in two different polarities. You'll notice at their bases, they're much more coherent, single large structures than they are at their tops, indicating their parentage. They have been, it's certainly possible that this region started out with two omega loops that were on their own ever since their origin. It's also possible that those basic omega loops, just like all the substructures you see, respond to what their size distribution implies. The size distribution of these guys has log normal form, which implies random bifurcation of the flux ropes. Random, repeated bifurcation. So, have they been through that? I don't know. But in any case, the important point for this talk, well, I do know. I'm sure as God made little green apples, that is what happens. But the important point for this talk is turbulence really bangs around these flux ropes as they go through the convection zone. They are really getting pummeled as they go up through there. And so that, by the end of the story, is going to be, that is what is responsible for what you might think of as the flakiness of these various hemispheric trends. It may be that the hemispheric helicity rule in a statistical sense, an okay rule. In fact, it is. But you look at an individual active region or a very short period of time, and that very short period of time may be a couple of years, you're going to get a lot of variation about the hemispheric helicity rule as a result of the role of the convection zone in creating that rule. Now, let's discuss what this has to do with George Ellery Hale. Hale, in 1908, published a paper about what he called vortices. He invented, when he was a grad student, an instrument which is really powerful and innovative in his day, called a spectroheliscope, which had the ability to form images that were images in the chromosphere. Well, okay, that was really a sea change. For the first time, you could see a layer in the sun's atmosphere, you could see structures of a layer in the sun's atmosphere that was magnetically dominated. It was not like the photosphere. It wasn't dominated by the gas pressure forces. It was dominated by magnetic forces. And so Hale, of course, didn't know that. And so some of his first discoveries were, you know, had he been aware of it, he would have attributed these vortices to something other than what he did. But we'll get to that in a minute. The point is, he discovered them with his spectroheliscope in 1908, and by 1927, he'd published a paper from which this is a figure is taken, which showed vortex direction of alpha spots and showed the hemispheric trend, namely that the handedness or the sense of vorticity was opposite in the two hemispheres. And he plotted three different cycles in this interesting way. So this is one cycle here, this is the next cycle, this is the next cycle. So using this figure, he demonstrated, he was telling us, look, the vortex direction depends on hemisphere, and it doesn't depend on cycle. Well, okay, we've already heard about the hemisphere rule a bit, there's just another one. What is the vertical motion that he used to attribute this to? Well, in the northern hemisphere, if you look in the convection zone where you have gases rotating and rising as a result of the instabilities that produce convection and spreading just by geometric effects, subject to the Coriolis force, and that's the obviously the dominant effect. In the northern hemisphere, they're left-handed. You can, you know, get out your hand and do your thing, and left-handed in the northern hemisphere and right-handed in the southern hemisphere. So why have I got this question mark in here? Simply because Hale attributed this to these vortices existed in the atmosphere of the chromosphere, and we now know, well, okay, the chromosphere doesn't work that way. The chromosphere, structure of the gas is defined by the structure of the magnetic field and not the other way around. So how about the vortices? Well, Hale was on the right track. He just put his vortices in the chromosphere, in the magnetically dominated chromosphere, rather than in the gas pressure dominated solar convection zone. So that's the only question. Let me move on to the next slide to just more or less, more than anything, to establish the nomenclature of magnetic helicity. We've already talked about the basic definition of helicity, so I won't go into that. And because of its historical use, I will mention that Volcher in 1958 showed us that, or discussed in detail, an important property of force-free fields, namely that force-free fields were could be written in terms of a parameter alpha, which is turns out is a measure of twist. That's no surprise. You look, you have the curl of B over here and B over here. Alpha is obviously going to be a measure of twist. Well, so let's think about how that was used historically. Before we can do that, we need to define the things that are the subject, that are part of the title of the talk. Namely, we need to define the concept of twisted writhe in simple cases. We need to talk about linking, which actually Spiro has already done, so I won't spend much time on that. The difference between self and mutual helicity, what do those words mean? And conservation. Of all these things, conservation is really the paramount concept that we want to think about, but and that's illustrated by this figure here. Helicity started out in the framework of topology, of mathematics, and we in solar physics have only come to benefit with this, from this concept recently, but that's a story for a later slide. You know, this cartoon from a paper by Moffat and Rica shows how if you start out with just a paper ribbon and you, let me see if I can use this guy. You start out with a paper ribbon, which somebody's nicely painted for you, and the you bend the axis so that it goes like this, that this bending of the axis is what we call the writhe. And if you grab the ends of this paper ribbon and you extend it through torsion, you create a ribbon that whose axis is straight. Hence, it has no writhe, but you have field lines going around that axis in what we call twist. So that's the twisting and writhing. And the nice little cartoon movie by that Dana provided me nicely shows the fact that as you look at this carefully, as that ribbon is writhed, you see, let's try that again. You see the conservation of helicity in that simple loop framework. I show that because it's relevant to the next slide. So let's think about what you can think about that in the framework of loops popping up through the photosphere shown in red, and we'll do that in a minute. The other aspect of helicity is related to the linking number. Spiro used that in the sort of the standard simple discussion of the robust nature of helicity in the face of reconnection. The left-hand torus here has no twist about the axis whatsoever, and the axis is just continuous. That has a helicity of zero. In this case, all the field lines twist around the axis once, and so in any case, the twist would be 360 degrees per turn around the torus, and the helicity in physical units, the twist times the flux squared. Here is a structure that has two untwisted loops but are linked, and in fact, linking number provides a common heritage for all these concepts and is of this form. The helicity is the double sum, the linking number times the flux of the two linked tubes. And if it's only one loop we're talking about, then it's what we call self-helicity. So the self-helicity of this loop here is one, the twist. And when we have two completely separate loops, that's what we call mutual helicity. And so what I'm going to talk about briefly in a minute, in the second part of the talk, actually, is the conversion of mutual helicity to self-helicity through magnetic reconnection. Let's see. Let's talk about why we got into this discussion of topology. And you'll see in the next slide, well, blame George Ellery Hale. The Hale's vortices today, the hemispheric twist rule, we've heard of that hemispheric twist rule discussed in Pete Martin's talk, in which he showed a sample of filaments, and I guess sigmoids also, that showed the, or I should say, didn't very strongly show the hemispheric twist rule. Here's a result of some work that I did with Alex Peftsoff over a decade ago, which I think was maybe the first statistically significant indication of the hemispheric twist rule. Each point on this figure is one active region. If it's measured more than once, the scatter of that measurement is shown by the error bar. The quantity that's plotted is the alpha. That is the force-free field parameter. The quantity alpha is just used as a convenient measure of twist because we know physically that the region in which it's measured, namely the photosphere, is not a force-free region. The important point here is that when error bars, our range of measurement is given, as it is for many active regions, the range of that of those measurements is sometimes very, very large. That's a single active region. And when it's averaged, as this alpha is over the active region, you look at successive ones, even in spite of that averaging, one day's measurement might be, this is from the day in which magnetograms were made just a few times a day, vector magnetograms were made just a few times a day, the results are very different. That's not a measure of the scatter that's intrinsic in the magnetogram measurement. Vector magnetograms and the alpha that's fitted to them are much more accurately determined than that scatter. It's a consequence of the fact that the origin of these this is an assertion, of course, at this point in time. The origin of these variations from day to day, magnetogram to magnetogram, lies in the origin of the twist. The convection zone, turbulence, a time scale that's short compared to that of, say, daily observations. The hemispheric rule, northern hemisphere, alpha is negative. Southern hemisphere alpha is positive, that is to say left-handed and right-handed. One cycle, next cycle, same rule. Huge amounts of scatter in some cases. Interesting. So, the sigma effect model is a model that was designed by people who knew what they were doing. I didn't know what I was doing at this time. I couldn't have explained. I mean, I tried the application of beer to the solution of this problem, beer in conversation with colleagues in meetings, and it didn't work. But these guys tried the application of understanding of a very simple concept, namely the conservation of magnetic helicity, to this problem, and it works fine. So let me show you how they did it. They recognized that when you have a horizontal magnetic field, as indicated here, and you entrain that field in these vertical flows that exist in the convection zone, that you convert, you create from that untwisted, unwrithed flux tube, entrained in that left-handed vortex, you create a left-handed structure, left-handed writhe structure, and in the southern hemisphere, you do just the opposite. You have this right-handed flow, and when you entrain in it, the magnetic field, you create that right-handed writhed structure. If you understand that and you build a model that takes a horizontal thin flux tube, helical turbulence, you use mixing length theory to describe the temporal and spatial scales, you make the all-important assumption of felicity conservation in your explanation, and you take a Monte Carlo approach because you have many different realizations of this interaction between convective turbulence and magnetic field. And what happens to that straight flux tube that you start out with? Well, if you look at it from on side, it gets bumped all over the place by that convection. Look at it 90 degrees different view, it looks like that. So that's the same flux tube viewed two different ways. If you look down the axis, you can see that there is a rotation about the axis of the tube, and this is the same figure, just rotated by 90 degrees. So what you've done is you have imbued that that originally straight tube with writhe and owing to helicity conservation, you have created a whole lot of writhe. Helicity conservation has converted that into twist, and after all, that's what our alpha that we made measurements of measured. Their simulation with these Monte Carlo methods and the sigma effect model showed that you should expect about, from the mixing length theory, should expect about this variation, negative in the northern hemisphere, positive in the southern hemisphere, and if you average over the spatial scale of an active region, a range about like that. So this agreement between the predictions of the sigma effect model and the observations is striking. And so I think at this point, the only issue that remains is the lack of solar cycle dependence, and the Coriolis force has a way of not knowing much about the solar cycle. So I think things are copacetic. I'm going to briefly zoom off to, modern CMEs, flares, and so forth. Dan, how much time do I have left? Twenty minutes? Okay. Generous to a fault, that man. Okay. Thing that I found, as I said, drinking beer and talking to colleagues didn't solve this problem. But in hindsight, it's so simple that helicity conservation was you know, played such a central role in this problem. And so not long ago, I became aware of the Bozeman connection in Robert Persig's famous book on the Zen and art, the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. That man's a wise man. You're not going to understand the hemispheric rule unless you take into account helicity conservation. You're not going to understand flares and CMEs unless you take into account helicity conservation and, oh, by the way, magnetic reconnection. So in the next slide, we'll turn to that topic, the relationship between eruptive events in the corona and space weather. That'll be the focus of the remaining part of the talk. So during the last 30 years or so, magnetic helicity has gone from a mathematical concept nicely dealt with by mathematicians and almost only dealt with by mathematicians, to a measurable physical quantity. For example, for a set of active regions, this figure on the right shows the relationship between the magnetic helicity, in this case, the relative magnetic helicity, which is a measure relative to the potential field, and the free magnetic energy of active regions producing a variety of flares. These are flares less than M, the blue ones. The red boxes are M flares. The X's, asterisks, are X flares. One 20 or 30 years ago, there's no way using any method you could have produced on the basis of observational data, and these many tens of active regions, those are real numbers in Maxwell squared on the helicity axis and ergs on the energy axis for all those active regions. The field has proceeded greatly as a result of the contributions of these people. I don't mean to imply this is this method by these guys is the only way of getting this information, but it is a method which is very friendly to doing a whole lot of active regions. And as Pete has reminded us, that's an important way of doing things. And so it has given us some insight into the relationship between magnetic helicity and free magnetic energy that I'll show. And there are various ways of doing this. One of them is to construct an instantaneous 3D coronal magnetic field from a photospheric vector magnetogram, what I would call the coronal reconstruction method, and people have used that very effectively in the past and today. And the second is calculating the flux of magnetic helicity and energy into the corona using magnetogram sequences. This is an example of one method of doing the first one, but I'm going to concentrate mostly on the second method in the balance of this talk. I guess probably we'll see this movie a good many times in this meeting, but let me show it because it shows up two important points. This is a roughly 4-day video of Active Region 1158, thanks to Lucas Tarr, from SDO, from HMI. And both spinning and shearing motions are very evident in this video, so as well as flux emergence and a basic attribute, namely the discrete nature of magnetic flux elements as seen in such a video. So up in this region, I'm going to show this one again. A lot of the shearing and electric fields that George Fisher was talking about are found. In this region over here, dramatic spinning occurs about 2/3 of the way through this video. And so let's look at it one more time, and you'll see that about 3/4 of the way through this time sequence. In particular, while at the same time the shearing is taking place, do have a look at the dramatic spinning that's occurring over in this part of the active region. What's going on in the framework of those omega loops that I was discussing earlier? That particular omega loop had an interaction where it got whacked hard, had its axis really distorted, created a lot of writhe. That twist propagated away from that writhe region, was propagated up through the photosphere into the corona. That's the interpretation that I think is an appropriate interpretation for that. That's just a qualitative interpretation, though. And what I was telling you was, look, we're in an entirely different era in the magnetic helicity business. We're in an era where quantitative calculation of the rate of emergence of energy and magnetic helicity through the photospheric boundary into the corona can be and is measured. Now, largely as a result of the work by all of these guys, and I haven't even started to list the number of people in this room who are working on some aspect or another, but it's a very active field, and that's demonstrated by this diagram of citations to a paper by Berger and Field, which in 1984 was the seminal paper in this field. These two guys actually derived the key expressions for helicity and Cassano et al. For energy. Look at the rate of citation of the Berger and Field paper as a function of time. This starts out in 84. Here we are today, halfway through the year. We're going to hit the top. It's been a very interesting and stimulating business. Mind you, it's still a young business. And so people will argue until the cows come home about what this means, whether you did it right, whether your model is the right one to use, whether you analyze the data with the right technique and so forth. And that will continue to happen, I'm sure, for a good long while. So let's see. What I want to do is to, basically say, in my view, the biggest advance is underway right now is the fact that we now have, not only do we have vector magnetogram sequences, but we have vector magnetogram sequences from space, and not only do we have them from space, but they're virtually continuous, and not only are they virtually continuous, they have high enough resolution so that it's a much less important factor. Now, I guess I've got the essential things, namely cadence, continuity, quality of observation. If you've been in the vector magnetogram business for a while, as some of us in the room have, you know vector magnetograms are fraught with challenges, but this vector magnetogram shows a number of interesting things. Among other things, if you look at this area, these arrows show the vector magnetic field. An arrow that long is 2,000 Gauss long. And look at the structure here. Look at how, Hale, if you were looking at H-alpha, would have seen a spiral structure in H-alpha, because after all, he was looking at magnetically controlled features. He would have seen a vortex there. As a result of the expressions that, of the equations that I showed in the previous figure, any number of people have recently, in the last few years, calculated figures like this one from Yu and Shuck. And what do they show? They show the flux of helicity through the photosphere in that magnetogram in physical units as a function of hours since they started doing it. And the fact is, and here's the same quantity for energy, the different curves that are shown there are separations of into the emergence term and the shearing and braiding term. That's not the point of my talk. The thing that is related to my talk is this. There are all kinds of fluctuations in these quantities. There have been numerous papers over the last almost decade on the relationship between these fluctuations, flares, CMEs. You want your answer, you'll find the paper that's got it. It's really, it's a measure of how young this field is, really in practical terms. My point is actually different from this, though. If your goal is to say something in a predictive kind of sense, for example, about the relationship between an event that occurred on the sun and how it affected Earth, then the work that's being done is still in its infancy. Why is that? Not only are there uncertainties, observational uncertainties, which are very large, but these plots refer to the region as a whole. Well, let's ask a rhetorical question. When a CME occurs that's related to an active region, does the active region go away? If a flare occurs in an active region, does the magnetic field in that active region go away? Of course not. So for this particular problem, looking at the active region as a whole just isn't the right approach. No doubt there's a lot of interesting physics in studying the active regions as a whole, but if you want to do anything predictive about the energy loss in a flare or radiative energy loss in a flare or the energy output, kinetic energy output of a CME or something else like that, you better not be thinking about the active region as a whole. You better take into account magnetic reconnection. You better take into account topology, which of course is the brother of magnetic reconnection. So let's remind ourselves that one of the nice things that, the kind things that magnetic reconnection does for us in the presence of helicity is it converts mutual helicity, two separate flux bundles linking in some way, to self-helicity, creating a flux rope. This is one of many mechanisms and scenarios that rightly speaking, you'll find in the literature, and in which an active region replicate all these two simple colors, positive and negative, has been in time rotated so that a structure is created across the neutral line that like the filaments that Spiro was talking about, is highly sheared. And then after a certain period of time, turn on convergence or spreading of these things so that along the polarity inversion line, flux is driven together, it submerges, and the total flux content of the active region changes. Obviously a mechanism, not the only mechanism around. And then let reconnection start taking place at the boundary, at the polarity inversion line. Let's witness the conversion from the mutual helicity of these structures here to the self-helicity, the creation of the twisted flux rope, and then the eruption of that flux rope, which, by the way, if you can't relate in any way to the mere fact that it is a twisted flux rope if you're interested in the timing of things. This figure over here is intended to represent, remind you that that's got more to do with energetics and can be understood in terms of energetics. This sequence can be understood not only in terms of topology, absolutely imperative, but energetics, the other side of the coin. And both are important elements of what we see. I guess in 2 days we'll have the privilege of hearing Dieter Torek talk about eruption, and I'm looking forward to that. Okay, so by this mechanism, we've formed a flux rope. Does the sun know about that? Of course. So I gathered a couple of videos to help me make my point. One video that shows a CME with a core that you would associate with the eruption of a flux rope, and another video which by use of difference techniques, thanks to Ben Lynch, makes you believe, hey, there's at least one that's certainly got patently helical structure as nicely revealed because it's got such nice structure. I'll show it twice. Okay, so the sun certainly knows that we've formed a flux rope. What happens when that flux rope is launched from the sun and encounters Earth? Well, if you're a helicity enthusiast, then the challenge for you is the following. You are charged with predicting the leading field orientation when these flux ropes arrive at Earth. That is to say, in the jargon that we've talked about today, you're supposed to predict the magnetic cloud helicity. Is that the whole, no, that's not the whole space weather problem, but it's an interesting part of it. So let's recognize that when the sun launches one of these flux ropes, there's a turbulent sheath between that flux rope and the shock, and that turbulent sheath plays an important role. But the fact of the matter is that it's been known for a long time that the most severe space weather is associated with ropes whose leading magnetic field direction points south, pushing a sheath in front of it that also points south. And the rationale for identifying the orientation of that flux rope depends on the polarity of the Hale polarity of the region and the helicity of the magnetic cloud, the buzzword for a flux rope, and the orientation. Last several years, I've had the privilege of working with many of my colleagues at MSU on this problem that uses Dana's minimum current corona model and served as Masha Kazachenko's thesis. This model basically does a 3D topology calculation based on real data. The topology that we're going to talk about is so-called separators. In 2D, we have this X point. Its 3D equivalent is this separator. And by going through the necessary data, such as the video we showed of 1158, constraint and connect, deciding how the various flux elements are connected, insisting that they not change until the content of each domain here not change until a flare occurs, build in Faraday's law and Ohm's law, figure out the current that's running along a separator from those, calculate the separator energy and elicity, and assume that when flare reconnection occurs, those separator currents are fully dissipated. Use flare imaging to dissipate, to determine which separators actually were responsible for a given flare. If you do that, which is what Masha did for her thesis, you end up with a remarkably good agreement between that picture, which is supposedly the minimum energy involved in a flare, or say the minimum elicity involved in a flare, because you're only taking into account the current that builds along the separator and not any of the, that might have arisen in the solar dynamo or has arisen about the, from this, yeah, might have arisen from the solar dynamo or from the sigma effect, then you, after Masha did her thesis, well, the important thing happened is she got out and she got a PhD. The next best thing that happened is I started thinking about it a little bit more seriously because we had another goal in mind, namely to try to clean up little uncertain questions. And one of them we tried to clean up was this. Masha assumed that our lead, assumed that when a flare occurred, that it somehow zeroed out all the free energy content, and what you saw between successive flares was related to the buildup. Well, that's a pretty naive approach, but it's a good starting approach, and that's the one she took. We decided we needed to get rid of that, and we needed to replace it with the assumption that we could calculate it by the we could calculate the magnetic flux that was reconnected by from the motion of flare ribbons themselves. And so we adopted that approach rather than the assumption that a previous flare zeroed out all the energy and elicity. Let's see. I guess the second thing we did was we used those flare scaling laws about conductive energy losses and radiative energy losses and all that stuff that those of us who've lived 50 years in this business grew up on, threw all those out. We've got Eve up there doing these great spectrographic measurements, beautifully calibrated spectrographic measurements. Use that. You've got measurements, direct measurements of the energy output of a flare. So between those two, you can do the problem better. So this figure compares the energy output of four different flares to the model. Here's the plus symbols are the bolometric output of a flare, of four different flares. And the red curves are the original estimate using scaling laws and the like. The black is using the ribbon motions to nail down the observational aspect of the problem. And you'll notice the agreement is really remarkable. In every case, the the predictions of the MCC using ribbon motions to infer the reconnection flux fall within the error bars of the bolometric measurement from Eve. And magnetic helicity, that's almost too good to believe. Magnetic helicity, the results are that they all agree within the error bars. The worst case is this one, which the error bar is basically a butt. But you'll notice the error bars are huge, so that's somewhat less convincing. So I must be about done. Yep. So let me move on quickly to some interesting questions about active region helicity and energetics. I am fascinated by the reconstructions in MHD models. I'm fascinated about where some recent work, like the Sun et al. Work, for example, 2012 work tells us about where within the framework of an active region energy is lost. And it's very interesting to compare that with a model like Dana's, which makes a very specific prediction. Hey, of course, on separators, don't bother me anymore. And so where are we going on that? It'll be fascinating. The result from the fact that the MCC agrees so well with the observations tells us, look, all the energy and helicity that you got out in flares seems very well predicted by this simple model that separator storage is it. So how about all the distributed currents that we've long known are present in active regions? Well, let's find that out. We'll continue as vector magnetogram sequences and helicity find, will maps of those things find the dynamo effects that we know are there, or will something like the sigma, will the sigma effect explain all the twists that we see? What is the axial variation of magnetic helicity per unit length in magnetic clouds? Boy, you talk about a tough measurement. Try to figure out all that length of that magnetic cloud between us and the sun and how the twist in it is distributed in space along that. The most interesting work, I think, most compelling work is by Mistel, who used two spacecraft, but there's a very interesting paper by Gary and Moore on the on a twisted structure very early in an event through X-ray imaging, and how that involves how that evolves needs to be done. So the summary, look, the conservation properties of magnetic helicity nicely link the solar dynamo and convection zone to solar eruptive events and their interaction with the Earth's magnetic field, which is an important component of space weather. Secondly, these continuous high resolution temporal and spatial resolution observations are really enabling fascinating quantitative measurements, and it is now and will obviously continue to be an important field for decades to come. I'd like to thank you, the SPD, for this honor. I'd like to thank you for your attention, and I'd like to take a minute to thank the following students and postdocs, which I'm very proud. I've had a privilege of working with a number of PhD students, some of whom sit in this room, George Fisher, Katie Lecca, is Katie here? The recent crop, Angela Desjardins, Maria Kazachenka. I'm proud of you all. Postdoctoral fellows, it's been a two-way street for us all. Let's see. Is Dipen Dunandi in the room yet? No, he's not arrived yet. Is he going to arrive? No, he's not going to arrive. Too bad. Another. Alex Pefsoff, I know, is also a victim of the same problem. There are even some students, undergraduate RU students, that are sitting in this room. My own RU students, Michael Hahn, is right here. Let's see, Christopher Lauder is right here pushing the thing around. And in fact, I think if we took a, would anybody who's been part of the RU program at MSU raise their hand? I see several hands around. Delighted to see you. So I'd like to close by dedicating it. Thank you. I ask you all to wait for the delivery of the microphone like Jim has kindly done so that I can, in fact, hear your question.
Okay. So, Dick, under your tremendous leadership, for many years, the Mies Solar Observatory was the community's source of vector magnetograms, and those data were incredibly valuable. But, of course, today we have vector magnetograms of much higher spatial resolution. So I wonder, has anyone ever looked at the spatial power spectrum of current density, and perhaps the slope of that power spectrum? And the reason I ask is that, referring back to the very nice work that George did, and maybe you were involved, and Alex, relating the X-ray luminosity of various features to quantities like the total magnetic flux or the total unsigned current. You guys looked at currents that were resolvable currents in that era. Now we can see currents that are much smaller, and perhaps there are very likely currents that are smaller still that we don't yet resolve. So we can maybe get a handle on those currents by looking at the slope of the spatial power spectrum. Has anyone gone that way at all?
Well, I'm afraid that the properties of our observing tools have made that problem quite intractable. Why do I say that? Of course, I'm probably stepping on some toes by someone who has, in fact, done it and has dealt with the fact that a very limited range of spatial scales is available. Think, for example, to observation. Think has been in the past. Think, for example, of those days in which we were making those measurements from Meade Solar Observatory. Well, you probably had 20, 30 independent picture elements across an entire active region. So the dynamic range of the measurement, the scale range of the measurement was so limited that a power spectrum of currents, of the size of currents, would have been of such limited utility. On the other hand, with SDO, it's an entirely different story, isn't it? I mean, you have I don't know how many resolution elements with SDO over with HMI, say over an active region. Is it 100 at least independent, not messed up? So, the topic that you're discussing is a live one for the coming decade for sure.
So I'd like to respond to Jim's comment, which is the spatial resolution, as Dick said, with the Haleakala-Stokes polarimeter data we used to do that study in 98 was so coarse compared to what's available now. It begs to be done again. The whole project, it just begs to be done again.
Yeah, I want to make a comment, Dick. You mentioned that helicity is very useful independent of reconnection because it is a conserved topological quantity. The problem, though, is that it's not the only conserved topological quantity under an ideal evolution. There are many, it's an infinity of topological conserved quantities under an ideal evolution. So if your system were evolving ideally, it would definitely not evolve to a linear force-free field state. You know, the argument in Walsh's paper is just a huge assumption. But reconnection, under reconnection though, helicity is the only conserved quantity. And so that's what's so critical. So it's reconnection that makes helicity very, very special. So even in that kind of emergence model that you were talking about, I wonder if reconnection is playing a role in kind of cleaning out all the other topological conserved quantities.
I can only agree. Really, seriously. You don't want to oversell the utility of the concept and the role, and it's hard to undersell the role of reconnection in most of the processes that we're interested in.